Sergei Nietzsche was an anarchist revolutionist born in 1847 in Russia and died in 1882 at the age of 35. Sergei was essentially an extremist, and while he worked with other leftist slash anarchist revolutionaries in his time in Russia, he was always viewed to be just a bit extreme, full of passion, but also plagued by extremism, as viewed by his counterparts. In Catechism of a Revolutionist, Sergei exposes his extremism. But despite the extremism of his ideology, he was someone who practiced what he preached. So much so that when a member of his party question his methods, that member was executed. He was eventually put into prison for the murder. While in prison, the commandant had come in and offered him a deal that if he would essentially become a paid informant for them, that he can get released from his 20-year sentence. And Sergei, as you would imagine he would, responded by socking the commandant in the face, which led, I imagine, to many tortures and beatings in his jail cell after that. But they had shackled his hands and feet from there on out. And a few years later, he would end up dying of disease and sickness in his cell at the age of 35, which no doubt was a result of the treatment he got after he socked the commandant in the face for offering him the deal of becoming a snitch for the system. I guess they didn't read the Catechism of the Revolutionist and understand who they were dealing with. Whatever can be said about the man and his politics and his life, what cannot be denied was his fanaticism and his passion for his beliefs and his dedication to sacrifice all to bring those beliefs into fruition. So let's get into a little bit of what Sergei thought the mind of the revolutionist should be made of. From Chapter 2 of Catechism of the Revolutionist. The duties of the revolutionary toward himself. 1. The revolutionary is a doomed man. He has no personal interests, no business affairs, no emotions, no attachments, no property, and no name. Everything in him is wholly absorbed in the single thought and the single passion for revolution. 2. The revolutionary knows that in the very depths of his being, not only in his words, but also in his deeds, he has broken all the bonds which tie him to the social order and the civilized world with all its laws, moralities, and customs, and with all its generally accepted conventions. He is their implacable enemy, and if he continues to live with them, it is only in order to destroy them more speedily. 3. The revolutionary despises all doctrines and refuses to accept the mundane sciences, leaving them for future generations. He knows only one science, the science of destruction. For this reason, but only for this reason, he will study mechanics, physics, chemistry, and perhaps medicine. But all day and all night he studies the vital science of human beings, their characteristics and their circumstances, and the phenomena of the present social order. The object is perpetually the same, the surest and quickest way of destroying the whole filthy order. So essentially, and what you'll get at when reading Nietzsche's works, is that the mind of the revolutionist is that of the fanatic. You have to be obsessed with revolution. You have to be obsessed with destroying the order that exists. 4. The revolutionary despises public opinion. He despises and hates the existing social morality in all its manifestations. For him, morality is everything which contributes to the triumph of the revolution. immoral and criminal is everything that stands in its way. 5. The revolutionary is a dedicated man, merciless towards the state and towards the educated classes, and he can expect no mercy from them. Between him and them there exists, declared or concealed, a relentless and irreconcilable war to the death. He must accustom himself to torture. And Nietzsche lived to that. For however extreme Nietzsche was, what cannot be said was that he did not live up to his extremism. Even in death, as he faced the torture, this man of 35 years old did not break. What he has written and what he spoke about and what he preached may not have been followed and picked up by everyone else. It was something he lived to and died for. 6. Tyrannical towards himself. He must be tyrannical towards others. All the gentle and enervating sentiments of kinship, love, friendship, gratitude, and even honor must be suppressed in him and give place to the cold and single-minded passion for revolution. For him, there exists only one pleasure. On consolation, one reward, one satisfaction, the success of the revolution. Night and day, he must have but one thought, one aim, merciless destruction, striving cold-bloodedly and indefatigably towards this end. He must be prepared to destroy himself and to destroy with his own hands everything that stands in the path of the revolution. 7. The nature of the true revolutionary excludes all sentimentality, romanticism, infatuation, and exaltation. All private hatred and revenge must also be excluded. Revolutionary passion, practiced at every moment of the day until it becomes a habit, it is to be employed with cold calculation at all times and in all places. The revolutionary must obey not his personal impulses, but only those which serve the cause of the revolution. So it's becoming clear that his belief of what the proper revolutionist is someone who is completely obsessed with revolution. And he is definitely not wrong in his thinking, as people obsessed with any aspect of life, they're obsessed with it when it achieves success in it, their obsession helps them achieve success in it. So he applied this mentality to that of the revolutionary. You had to be obsessed with the idea of revolution, with the result of revolution. The relations of the revolutionary towards his comrades. 8. The revolutionary can have no friendship or attachment, except for those who have proved by their actions that they, like him, are dedicated to the revolution. The degree of friendship, devotion, and obligation towards such a comrade is determined solely by the degree of his usefulness to the cause of total revolutionary destruction. So essentially, in your social life, no one exists except for those that have proved through merit that they are dedicated as you are to that of the revolutionary ideal. 9. It is superfluous to speak of solidarity among revolutionaries. The whole strength of revolutionary work lies in this. Comrades who possess the same revolutionary passion and understanding should, as much as possible, deliberate all important matters together and come to unanimous conclusions. When the plan is finally decided upon, then the revolutionary must rely solely on himself. In carrying out acts of destruction, each one should act alone, never running to another for advice and assistance, except when they are necessary for the furtherance of the plan. 10. All revolutionaries should have under them second or third degree revolutionaries, i.e., comrades who are not completely initiated, These should be regarded as part of the common revolutionary capital placed at its disposal. This capital should, of course, be spent as economically as possible in order to derive it from its greatest possible profit. The real revolutionary should regard himself as capital concentrated to the triumph of the revolution. However, he may not personally and alone dispose of that capital without the unanimous consent of the fully initiated comrades. 11. When a comrade is in danger and the question arises whether he should be saved or not saved, the decision must not be arrived at on the basis of sentiment, but solely in the interest of the revolutionary cause. Therefore, it is necessary to weigh carefully the usefulness of the comrade against the expenditure of the revolutionary forces necessary to save him, and the decision must be made accordingly. The relations of the revolutionary towards society. 12. The new member, having given proof of his loyalty not by words but by deeds, can be received into the society only by unanimous agreement of all the members. 13. The revolutionary enters the world of the state, of the privileged classes, of the so-called civilization, and he lives in this world only for the purpose of bringing about its speedy and total destruction. He is not a revolutionary if he has any sympathy for this world. He should not hesitate to destroy any position, any place, or any man in this world. He must hate everyone and everything in it with an equal hatred. All the worse for him if he has any relationships with parents, friends, or lovers. He is no longer a revolutionary if he is swayed by these relationships. 14. Aiming at the implacable revolution, the revolutionary may and frequently must live within society, pretending to be completely different from what he really is. For he must penetrate everywhere, into all the higher and middle classes, into the houses of commerce, the churches and the places of the aristocracy, and into the worlds of bureaucracy and literature and the military, and also into the third division and the winter palace of the Tsar. 15. This filthy social order can be split up into several categories. The first category comprises those who must be condemned to death without delay. Comrades should compile a list of those condemned according to the relative gravity of their crimes, and the executions should be carried out accordingly to the prepared order. So obviously your main corruptors, they get the guillotine right away. 16. When a list of those who are condemned is made and the order of execution is prepared, no private sense of outrage should be considered. Nor is it necessary to pay attention to the hatred provoked by these people among the comrades of the people. Hatred and the sense of outrage may be even useful insofar as they incite the masses to revolt. It is necessary to be guided only by the relative usefulness of these executions for the sake of revolution. Above all, those who are especially inimical to the revolutionary organization must be destroyed. Their violent and sudden deaths will produce the utmost panic in the government, depriving it of its will to action by removing the cleverest and most energetic supporters. So planned assassinations of specific targets for reasons of strategy specifically, and not just simply for rebellion. 17. The second group comprises those who will be spared for the time being in order that, by a series of monstrous acts, they may drive the people into an inevitable revolt. So useful idiots. Step 1, kill the people that are most effective at promoting the current system. Step 2, don't kill the people that are most effective at pissing people off at the current system. 18. The third category consists of the great many brutes in high positions, distinguished neither by their cleverness nor by their energy, while enjoying riches, influence, and power in high positions by virtue of their rank. These must be exploited in every possible way. They must be implicated and embroiled in our affairs. Their dirty secrets must be ferreted out, and they must be transformed into slaves. Their power, influence, and connections, their wealth and their energy will form an inexhaustible treasure and a precious help in all our undertakings. So people they can blackmail or use to reach their greater goal. 19. The fourth category comprises ambitious office holders and liberals of various shades of opinion. The revolutionary must pretend to collaborate with them, blindly following them, while at the same time prying out their secrets until they are completely in his power. They must be so compromised that there's no way out for them, and that they can be used to create disorder in the state. So straight up puppets. 20. The fifth category consists of those doctrinaires, conspirators, and revolutionists who cut a great figure on paper or in their cliques. They must be constantly driven on to make compromising declarations. As a result, the majority of them will be destroyed, while a minority of them will become genuine revolutionaries. 21. The sixth category is especially important. Women. They can be divided into three main groups. First, those frivolous, thoughtless, and vapid women, whom we shall use as we use all third and fourth category of men. Second, women who are adherent, capable, and devoted, but whom do not belong to us because they have not yet achieved a passionless and austere revolutionary understanding. These must be used like the men of the fifth category. Finally, there are the women who are completely on our side, i.e., those who are wholly dedicated and who have accepted our program in its entirety. We should regard these women as the most valuable, or our treasures. Without their help, we would never succeed. Which is true. I mean, you have to have a male-female dynamic in your counter-revolutionary process. Just look at the female vote for someone like Hitler. You had to have the women on the same side as well. Which is also why it is advantageous to the powers that be to divide the sexes as they are doing today. The attitude of the society towards the people. 22. The society has no aim other than the complete liberation and happiness of the masses, i.e., of all the people who live by manual labor. Convinced that their emancipation and that the achievement of this happiness can only come about as a result of an all-destroying popular revolt, the society will use all its resources and energy towards increasing and intensifying the evils and miseries of the people until at last their patience is exhausted and they are driven into a general uprising. Common theme of reactionary revolution, it has to get worse before it gets better. 23. By a revolution, the society does not mean an orderly revolt according to the classical Western model, a revolt which always stops short of attacking the rights of property and traditional social systems of so-called civilization and morality. Until now, such a revolution has always limited itself to the overthrow of one political form in order to replace it by another, thereby attempting to bring about a so-called revolutionary state. The only form of revolution beneficial to the people is one which destroys the entire state to the roots and exterminated all the state traditions, institutions, and classes in Russia. He's exposing his anarchism here. 24. With this end in view, the society therefore refuses to impose any new organization from above. Any future organization will doubtless work its way through the movement and life of the people. But this is a matter of future generations to decide. Our task is a terrible, total, universal, and merciless destruction. Let's examine what he says there. With this end in view, the society therefore refuses to impose any new organization from above. Any future organization will doubtless work its way through the movement and life of the people. So, but this is a matter of future generations to decide. So any future organization will doubtless work its way through the movement of people. So the anarchist is acknowledging that organization will come about, but he thinks it will manifest organically once they've destroyed the aristocracy, once they've destroyed the system that is, that a newer system will be created through the people, and it will be something that is more beneficial to the people and the society. But his main ideology, his main presence in life, when he views the revolutionaries' presence in life, is that of destroying what currently exists. And that's his only thought process, his only mentality, is that. 25. Therefore, in drawing closer to the people, we must all make common cause with those elements of the masses which, since the foundation of the state of Muscovy, have never ceased to protest, not only in words but in deeds, against everything directly or indirectly connected with the state, against the nobility, the bureaucracy, the clergy, the traders, and the parasitic kulaks. We must unite with the adventurous tribes of the brigands, who are the only true genuine revolutionaries in Russia. What he means by that is pretty much criminals and robbers and just taking the violent action-oriented position, essentially. And finally, 26, to wield the people into a single, unconquerable, and all-destructive force, this is our aim, our conspiracy, and our task. So he was hell-bent on creating this just destructive, violent force to tear down the system piece by piece, bullet by bullet, murder by murder. As was said of him, that he suffered of all the rage from a serf towards his masters, and that's probably what motivated him and drove him in his life, which meant his essentially violent end. But I do think, even though he is a bit extreme and unrealistic, there's something to be said about the passion and the focus of Sergei Nietzsche that gives validity to his theories on revolution, and especially how he conducted his life and lived up to what he preached, makes him a person where his thoughts and his ideals and how he lived his life should all be considered and remembered. For further reading, check out The Catechism of a Revolutionist. To what of that one may apply to his life to become truly revolutionary in mentality.